Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Today, the Silver Spring State Park in Ocala is home to trails, sinkholes, and wilderness. But back in 1970, a recreational diver discovered something special, a mammoth calf and human artifacts preserved at the bottom of the Silver River, findings that some estimates put at roughly 10,000 years old. According to the Ocala Star-Banner, archaeologist and anthropologist Charles Hoffman began excavating the site, reporting findings that had the potential to rewrite the story of human migration in North America. But the paper reports Hoffman's work was largely ignored, even discredited, due to what was at the time the very new science of underwater archaeology. Fast forward to this summer, a team of Texas archaeologists are diving there again to see what else the site can reveal and to set the record straight about those findings from roughly 50 years ago. Joining us now to talk about the site and what researchers have learned there over the years at a recent summer dives is Morgan Smith, a doctoral student at Texas A&M University's Center for the Study of First Americans. He's leading a team of seven as they dive, document, and preserve new findings from the bottom of Silver River. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hey, how's it going, Julie?
It's going great. I'm looking forward to hearing about what you're discovering underwater there. We're talking about underwater archaeology at a site at the bottom of an Ocala River that's seeing renewed interest from researchers. Give us a call with questions or comments at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Morgan Smith, before we get to your work in recent years at this site in the Silver River, can you give me a little backstory about how it was discovered and the early archaeological findings there?
Absolutely. So in the 1960s and 70s, you know, Ocala was really a very, very small town with not a whole lot going on in it besides Silver Springs, big, almost Disneyland-like park at the time. But a truck driver from Ocala named George Guest was just kind of lazily swimming at the bottom of the river, and he worked his way down, just kind of hand fanning along the bottom to looking for any kind of Native American artifacts or fossils of any kind. And he swam along to the bend of one of the rivers and noticed some large bones coming out of the wall. And he fanned around there a little bit more, and he noticed that the bones were possibly associated with some artifacts that had also eroded at the site. So he notified a really well-known river diver by the name of Ben Waller, who was very well-respected as an avocational archaeologist and diver back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And Ben came out and they examined the site, and they both knew that people had been looking, again, this was about 40 years ago, people had been looking for evidence of man and megafauna existing east of the Mississippi. It had been documented in the western United States, but not so much in the east. And this find really piqued Waller's interest in the possible nail in the coffin to proving that, you know, people were in the east as early, if not earlier, than in the west. And so he notified Charles Hoffman, who was a professor at University of Florida at the time. And Hoffman came out here in 1973 and excavated the site, and he found the remains of two Columbian mammoths. So these aren't woolly mammoths. They're a relative, a southeastern relative of the woolly mammoth, in association with five fragments of stone tools and a single small little projectile point. In addition to that, two of the bones looked like they had been butchered. And so Hoffman did what at the time was the first underwater prehistoric excavation in the Americas. He was way ahead of his time in this regard. And he excavated the site for a single year with some students, and they reported their findings, and a lot of people had trouble with what he reported. One, as you said, because the underwater archaeology was very new to a lot of people, and people didn't think you could excavate underwater with the kind of precision needed to support such a big claim. And also, it just didn't really fit the pattern. You know, we've always kind of had this dogma of people coming in from Beringia and populating the Americas through the west to the east, and an early site in the east just kind of threw a wrench into that. So for a couple reasons, Hoffman's work was largely discredited and has been mostly ignored for the last 30 or 40 years.
So it sounds like it's windy where you're at. Are you, where are you?
I'm actually on the site right now. We're working with a team of anthropologists from Florida State University and Texas A&M University And we're down on the river about 5 days a week, excavating as much as we can in a very short amount of time.
Well, I appreciate you taking a break to talk with us about it. So people discredited what was found, and now you're out there looking at it again. Are people more open to the idea of underwater digs now?
Yes, people are. Underwater archaeology has really come onto its own as a demonstrably scientific way to work in the last decade or 20 years. What really helped a lot was shipwreck archaeology has really refined a lot of the methods used underwater, and we adopt a lot of those methods and use some of our own. But ever since when Hoffman started working there, scuba diving was really in its infancy as far as recreational diving was concerned. I mean, it had only been around for, a decade or two. Whereas now, with a lot more kind of shipwreck archaeological excavations all over the world, really, as well as submerged prehistoric excavations, people are starting to accept that, these sites, which were inundated by sea level rise from the last ice age, still exist intact underwater. So in a way, it's just working on terrestrial archaeological sites that are now underwater.
And
obviously, a lot more receptive to it.
Yeah, well, and obviously, I'm a layperson. I'm not an archaeologist. But I always hear about things underwater, and my impression of it is that the water helps to preserve things. Is that true or not?
That's absolutely true.
And that wasn't really known back then? That they didn't know that back in the 70s?
They did know that. They did know that a lot of fossils and artifacts that were coming from the rivers were well preserved compared to on land. But the thing that you really need for a solid archaeological site that everybody is going to accept is you need unequivocal artifacts, so things that were absolutely made by people. You need solid geologic context, and by that I mean a stratified site where there are different sediment layers that have built up gradually over time, slowly encasing artifacts in different sediment levels. And you need absolute radiocarbon dates. The issue that people had with underwater sites is they didn't believe that there could be secure geologic context found underwater. Artifacts had been found underwater, and even some radiocarbon dates had been reported from isolated artifacts found on the bottoms of the rivers. But in archaeology, the context is really everything, because if you find a mammoth bone next to a projectile point on the bottom of a river, those two items could have become associated with each other through a number of geologic processes. Rivers move a lot of sand and erode things. There are some rivers in North Florida where you can go down and find beer cans right next to mastodon bones because they just become associated with each other over time. And this is the thought that a lot of people had in mind, was that, hey, there's some geologic processes we don't understand, and this association can't really be true.
Okay, I see that. So you wouldn't assume, because there's a beer can next to a mastodon bone, that the mastodon was hanging out with people having beer. So, just the
exactly.
River kind of might have put these things together. So in what you're looking at, in this site that you're at right now, is it clear that those items became lodged in that area at the same time, or is there a way to figure that out?
Yes, so that's pretty much the reason why we're back. We have really two points of this work. Hoffman found unequivocal artifacts. There's no debating that what he found were made by people. The issues are the radiocarbon dating and the geologic context. So with the radiocarbon dating, Hoffman obtained some radiocarbon dates on the mammoth bone protein, and unfortunately, he was ahead of his time on this as well, because the science only came out on how to properly date bone protein about 20 years after Hoffman got the date. And unless you do a very specific set of chemical treatments to the bone, it will reliably be an unreliable age. It will always produce a bad age. So Hoffman got a date that was way off. It was about 11,000 years ago, which actually we know that it should be way older than that, because mammoths and mastodons and all kinds of other Ice Age animals died out around 12,700. So it was way too young, and that was another reason that people didn't really believe it. But as far as the geologic context goes, we are excavating, as precisely and as slowly as we can, and we're documenting and photographing and drawing the sediment layers while we go down, and we're recording what kind of material is coming from each layer. And we're trying to build a geologic history at the site to show to prove or disprove that the artifacts and the mammoth bones are associated with each other.
So you've been at this site since 2014?
Yes, we've been working there about 2 weeks every year until this year when we got a grant from the Felburn Foundation to come out and excavate the site. So we've been out here for about 4 weeks. The previous years, it was really tough to locate the site because this was pre-GPS, and, you know, the site recording wasn't accurate enough to put us kind of right down on top of the site underwater. So we spent some time poking around the area, trying to find exactly where Charles Hoffman excavated. And that was pretty much how we spent the first a couple weeks a year for the first 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So you have a team of 7 divers and experts at the site, correct?
I do.
And what are their different levels of expertise? What do they do?
So we have everything from people who specialize in stone tool technology, where the stone tool material is coming from, how people produce the stone tools, to people who specialize in sediments and soils that have developed underwater, as well as people who are specialized in the bone materials that you find on these Ice Age sites.
Those are some pretty specific areas of, like, really focused areas.
They are, yes.
Like, I'm the guy who knows about the layers of sediment as it rests on the bottom of a river. That is a very specific area of expertise.
It is quite specific, yeah.
So do all 7 people go down at once? Does everybody go down and look at the same time, or is one or two tasked with that?
Pretty much how it works. Yeah, pretty much how it works is we have 2 people that are diving at once, and they're on a surface-applied air, and they wear scuba diving equipment as a backup, just in case the air goes out. But so we have 2 people down. It's only about 10 feet deep or so. And 2 people dive, and they work for really as long as it takes to excavate a level. We excavate 10 centimeters, or if we're in the mammoth bone bed, we'll excavate 5 centimeters of sediment at a time. And we'll try to go as slowly as we can to be able to map every artifact or bone we find in its exact spot. And basically, the divers use what's kind of like an underwater vacuum cleaner, essentially, that siphons off the sediment, and that helps maintain visibility, and it helps us remove the sediment from the site. And then we have 1 person that acts as a safety diver who's always watching the divers. We have 1 person on a floating deck that the vacuum cleaner is kind of attached to, and basically the sediment that comes up that the divers are vacuuming is going through a series of sieves that are 2 different sizes. One is 1/4 inch, so pretty big holes, and the other is 1/16 inch. It's basically the size that you put on your windows to keep bugs out.
Oh.
And so those 2 screens catch anything that the divers miss, and then we have another person up on the surface doing paperwork and recording things that divers are writing down.
So the mastodon bones that you're dealing with, or that you're mammoth, I'm sorry, not mastodon, that you're seeing.
Okay.
Do you know how old those are at this point?
At this point, we don't. We actually just submitted a radiocarbon date on new bone that we've found from the site. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, it would be very surprising if these dates came back dating after 12,700 years ago. So I think we're probably talking in the range of 14,000 to 13,000 years ago when we were talking about how old this animal was butchered or killed or exploited.
Wow. So, and that would be a big find.
Yeah, it would be pretty interesting. We have other sites in Florida that are very early as well. There's one on the Estilla River that the Center for the Study of the First Americans also worked on, and that one puts people in Florida undebatably at around 14,500 years ago. So we know people were here, but it's just kind of, if the site does date as early as we think it may date, it's another piece to the puzzle of kind of understanding how Florida fits into the peopling of the Americas, because as of right now, Florida really doesn't fit in at all. You know, if you're coming in from Siberia or Alaska, the last place you're going to expect people to be here early is Florida. So it's just a really puzzling really puzzling find, and it could be really interesting.
Well, you know, we were talking a couple of weeks ago with a geneticist talking about the Florida panther, and she was talking about how the Florida panther came to Florida, and what she has found through her genetic research is that it came up from South America and then came up over into Florida and then receded back over west of the Mississippi. But then there's a little pocket in Florida that stayed here. So,
oh, fascinating. I didn't know that.
I don't really know exact what time zone that is because I'm not real great on the memory there. But I do remember her talking about that's how that they traveled here. So do you think that this kind of information that you're uncovering might make us reexamine our ideas about human migration?
I think so. I think it definitely kind of has to bring Florida into the mix when people are discussing how people got into the Americas, which really doesn't fit into any of our models as it stands. So it is going to make us rethink a lot of things. And in addition, we typically don't find evidence of what we say megafauna. So when I say megafauna, that's like Ice Age animal. We typically don't find evidence of megafauna and people interacting in the East as much as the West. And the reason we think that is because there's so many more resources in the Southeast than the American West. So there was a lot more flora and fauna. So this would also kind of be interesting in regards to how these early people lived and subsisted, because it's the kind of evidence that we haven't really seen yet in the greater Southeast. But yeah, so it has the potential to answer a lot of questions and raise some of its own.
It could really change some things. Are there any other unanswered questions that you have about the Silver River site or the ancient human history of Florida that you want to have answered?
There are so many questions that I have. I mean, it's really, Florida just doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you start considering all the data that we have in the people in the Americas. You know, there are old sites that are a similar age in areas like Oregon and Texas, but there's really not a whole lot of data that we can use to construct an obvious movement of people through the Americas. And we shouldn't really expect a whole lot of information, because I think, and most scholars I think would agree, that this is a very small group of people that are traveling lightly and moving quickly across the landscape. So their signature is going to be very ephemeral. But the thing that I would really like to see are possibly some early campsite kind of areas from Florida that are excavated and understood, because these hill sites are fascinating and they tell us a lot, but what really tells us a lot is where we can find when we find evidence of a place that people sat down in and lived for a certain amount of time, because then we find evidence like the tools they used, the materials that they would have, their diet remains from what they ate.
Yeah.
And it just gives so much more insight into how people lived, and we can understand a campsite versus a kind of isolated kill like the Guest Mammoth.
Exactly. Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we've run up against time, but I want to thank our guest, Morgan Smith with Texas A&M University Center for the Study of First Americans. Good luck to you and your dive team as you continue your work on that site.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Julie. Have a good day.
You too. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1 FM. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 NPR for Southwest Florida.